Today on the 21st, we continue listening back to some of our favorite segments from the year. While COVID-19 dominated the news and many of our broadcasts, today we want to focus on conversations on important news stories that were not the pandemic. First, we talk about the proposed Pretrial Fairness Act, which aims to end cash bond, and hear from two activists. Then, we'll talk with two Illinoisans who helped fight the disastrous wildfires that raged across the western U.S. this summer. And we'll hear from the 2021 Illinois Teacher of the Year. He's Justin Johnson, the band director at Niles West High School in Skokie. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. This year, the pandemic has dominated the news and was a major topic on many of our broadcasts. But as we continue revisiting some of our favorite segments from 2020, today we wanted to focus on stories that were not about COVID-19, at least not directly. Later, we'll hear from two of our fellow Illinoisans who helped fight the wildland fires in California and Colorado, and Illinois' 2021 Teacher of the Year, band director Justin Johnson. But first, innocent until proven guilty. In the U.S., the presumption of innocence is supposed to be a core tenet of the criminal justice system, but a majority of inmates in Illinois jails are there awaiting trial because they can't afford to pay their bond. Some lawmakers are calling for an end to cash bond in the state's jails, saying it disproportionately affects the poor. In November, State Senator Robert Peters, a Democrat from Chicago, filed the Pretrial Fairness Act. It's intended to end money bond. It also proposes other changes that would require courts to provide pretrial services, making it easier for people charged with crimes to appear in court. I began speaking about this with Malik Alim from the Chicago Community Bond Fund. Later in the conversation, we were joined by Molly Galloway, who is a member of the Champaign County Bailout Coalition. Here now is that conversation. Malik, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Malik, I want to begin with you. Your organization has a network of volunteers who review cases and help determine which individuals you will help post bond for if they're in jail pretrial because they can't afford the money bond. Can you tell us about some of the types of cases that you see where people are being incarcerated pretrial and cannot pay?
Sure. Yeah, we see a variety of cases where people are ending up in jail. A judge has determined that they are not a danger to their community and can be released as long as they pay this dollar amount. So we see, a variety of charges ranging from, traffic offenses to, people accused of theft, anything in between. And so our goal on one side of our organization is to kind of garner all of the resources that our community has placed in our hands and entrusted us with, and use that to free people. But on the other side of our organization, the side that I do most of my work, is focused on ending that process and ending the practice of charging people money for their freedom.
And where do you focus that work? Is this an issue mostly for the state legislature? Is this an issue for individual judges? Is it something that, do prosecutors have a role? Where are you focusing your energy?
So we are focusing on the state legislature. We have 102 counties in Illinois, which means that we have 102 different chief judges that that preside over those counties, and they are in charge of giving the judges that represent those districts mandates for how they pursue charges and things of that nature. But the state legislature is in charge of criminal justice policy writ large. So we've been advocating in the state legislature for a couple of years. We've also been attempting to pursue litigation in certain areas that have especially egregious practices in terms of a money bond. In some areas like St. Clair County, the Metro East area, we see that a lot of judges there are into the practice of using money bond as a way to keep people in jail, which kind of goes beyond beyond their authority. Bond is supposed to be used as a measure to make sure that people come back to court and not as a punishment measure for people who have not been convicted of a crime.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned the Metro East area. And Molly, I want to bring you into the conversation now, because I think a lot of people know that Cook County Jail is said to be one of the largest systems in the country. And I think there might be a perception that this is more of, you know, sort of an issue for bigger metropolitan areas. Chicago, Cook County on the one hand, the Metro East area, the Illinois side of St. Louis on the other. But I mean, there are 92 county jails around the state. I wonder if you can talk about how this plays out in the rest of Illinois.
Yes. And so I'm from Champaign, Urbana, right? That's where I currently reside.
Sure.
And we are asked often, kind of, isn't this just a Chicago problem? But a few years ago, some members of the Champaign County Bailout Coalition went through and did the tedious work of going through the county jails data and found that there were no less than 70% of people that were in pretrial or that were in detention at the county jails were pretrial, right? So this is definitely still a problem in places like Champaign. Not only that, there's about a year ago or not too long ago, they also took all the lockers out of the courthouse. So that means that, and people aren't allowed to take their phones or really hardly anything into the courthouse with them, right? So that means people who were to take the bus or any means of transportation outside of a car. And then even with that, you have to pay for parking at the courthouse, mm-hmm. right? So that creates a barrier to even going to court. Not only that, not really having places to take your kids, right? Having to find childcare. So there's still definitely barriers in other places to going to court, that if those barriers didn't exist, then people wouldn't necessarily have to be in jail in order to get them to court, right?
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are rebroadcasting today my conversation about abolishing cash bail in Illinois. Molly Galloway is with the Champaign County Bailout Coalition, and Malik Alim is with the Chicago Community Bond Fund. Here's the rest of our conversation, which originally took place in mid-November. Malik, I want to ask you, in 2017, Illinois passed the Bail Reform Act. This was under Governor Bruce Rauner, a Republican. It made it so that people charged with nonviolent misdemeanors and other low-level felonies are eligible for release without posting bail. They could be subject to other restrictions like house arrest or an ankle monitor, but Malik, you're advocating for an end to money bail altogether, right? Can you talk about why those 2017 changes did not go far enough?
Sure. Those changes were not, they did not mandate the removal of money as a determining factor for freedom. So they gave judges the discretion to make those decisions, but they did not take away the ability for people to be charged money for their freedom. And I think that's very important because discretion is useful in a lot of ways, but when there are entrenched practices, generations of using money bond in the wrong way and in ineffective ways. When you kind of open up the ability for judges to choose, oftentimes they will revert back to what they know. And so, you know, it is better policy. It is better. It is more fair to remove the factor of money in determining whether or not someone will be free before they've even been convicted of a crime. In order to restore the presumption of innocence, we believe that money should not play a role in those decision-making processes. If someone has been deemed available for release, then they should be released, and then they should come back to court, and they should see it through to the end of that process.
I want to note that the Illinois Sheriff's Association has been very outspoken in its opposition to ending money bond. We did invite them to participate in this conversation. They were not available and instead referred us to some articles where their executive director, Jim Kitchuk, was quoted. He has said, quote, the coalition unequivocally and unanimously opposes eliminating cash bail. Elimination, and I should say that's the law enforcement coalition he's talking to. Elimination is not the way to make the criminal justice system more equitable, and it is not the way to make our communities safer, end quote. Malik, law enforcement groups have said that eliminating cash bail would make it so that fewer people show up to court. The McDonough County Sheriff, Nicholas Pettigout, said he has issued more arrest warrants for failure to appear since 2017. I wonder, what would you say in response to that?
Well, I would say that eliminating what that body perceives as the reason that people come back to court without offering support systems and actually filling the gaps where that people are experiencing in terms of why they aren't able to show up to court. What we see at the Chicago Community Bail Fund is that most people are not willful flight risks. Most people do not want to go on the run and be fugitives from the law. When we pay people's bonds, they show back up to court and they want to continue to see their case through to the end. But that's not their money that's being used to post that bond. And so when we see that, you know, the support systems, the reminder calls, we also offer people rides to court if they need them. We also offer those types of supports that we believe should be coming from the state government rather than extracting resources from communities who already can't afford them. We should be giving people the support that they need in order to be able to show up to court. I have a personal story that, you know, a lot of people don't, a lot of people kind of attach this idea of who is in the criminal justice system to, you know, this big scary idea of criminals. But, you know, driving on a suspended license, for example, is a jailable offense. And I was jailed for that offense a couple of years ago. And the only reason that my license ended up being suspended is that I could not figure out a way to make it back to the county where I was given that ticket to show up to court. And so we see that a lot with the people that we deal with in Chicago and across the state. Most people want to not be on the radar of law enforcement and they want to go on with their lives.
Hmm. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that story, Malik. You know, Molly, I wonder what your perspective, I mean, you talked about some of the barriers people have to showing up in court. Do you see something similar to what Malik was referring to there?
So actually thinking about the cost on communities, right? And not only financial, but the emotional and psychological burden, I definitely feel like exist, right? Even outside of places like Chicago. Just my own personal story, whenever I was roughly 5 months pregnant, the father of my child ended up getting taken to county jail. And even to talk on the phone with him after I had our kid, right? Just so our kid could hear his voice for up to 30 minutes a day, ended up costing $36 a week, right? Wow. So over an extended period of time, that easily adds up into the thousands of dollars. And again, that's only for 30 minutes, right? And because of that, and him not being able to be released because we couldn't afford his bond and there wasn't, or his bail, his money bail, and there wasn't any place like Chicago Community Bond Fund in Champaign County at the time. He wasn't able to actually take part in most of his defense. That was also something that was put on us. And it was, he has other kids. And so that was also put on us trying to prepare them for what could possibly happen.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Well, this is, we are running out of time in this segment. Malik, I guess I just want to close with you and maybe just a few sentences. I mean, what do you think the prospects are for this legislation? I mentioned at the top of the segment. I mean, do you have a sense of whether legislators are eager to pass this in Illinois?
I think legislators understand across the state that the cost of charging communities that are already struggling financially, the cost of, you know, making them come up with thousands of dollars for their freedom before they've even been convicted of a crime, those costs, people, you know, have people have children, people have jobs, people have housing, and all of those things are put at risk.
And we're going to have to leave it there. That was my conversation recorded in mid-November with Malik Aleem, who is with the Chicago Community Bond Fund, and Molly Galloway, who is with the Champaign County Bailout Coalition. I should also mention that the Pretrial Fairness Act, which we were talking about in this segment, is sponsored by State Senator Robert Peters, who is a Democrat from Chicago. I actually interviewed him separately in December. You can find that show and all of our other previous segments on our website, which is 21stshow.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast there, which is a great way of keeping up with the 21st in case you miss our broadcast on the radio. You can find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR One, just about anywhere you get your podcasts. Just search for The 21st. Coming up after the break, we'll be continuing with some of our favorite segments on 2020 news stories that were not the pandemic. Next up, I'll be talking with two Illinoisans who helped fight wildland fires in California and Colorado. And later this hour, I'll be talking to the Illinois State Board of Education 2021 Teacher of the Year, Justin Johnson, a band director at Niles West High School in Skokie. That's all coming up after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. All this week, we're re-airing some of our favorite conversations from the year. Today, we're focusing on important news stories that did not directly involve the COVID-19 pandemic. For weeks, back in September, destructive wildfires were spreading across the western United States. Two of our fellow Illinoisans were dispatched to California and Colorado to help in the fight. I spoke with Chief Warrant Officer 4 Jason Rassi, the pilot in command of an Illinois Army National Guard CH-47 Chinook helicopter. He and his crew helped fight wildfires in California. I also spoke with Tom Gargave, a forester and fire manager with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. He led a crew of wildland firefighters working on the Pine Gulch fire in Colorado. Here now is our conversation. Chief Rassi, I want to begin with you. You were the pilot in command, as I said, for the Illinois National Guard helicopter. Just completed a mission in Northern California during the wildfires. Can you paint a picture for our listeners? What's it like out there? What did you see from your vantage point in the sky?
Well, as we were flying the aircraft out there, it took us 2 days to get there. And as we crossed the Rockies coming westbound, it was you could definitely see the smoke. The visibility was reduced in the area. Our phones were telling us, the air quality is down a lot less. Things that we've never seen on our phones here in Peoria for sure. But as we got over there, one of the recommendations from some of the California pilots was actually to fly higher altitudes and fly instruments to get above the smoke, because the visibility from time to time can be pretty bad. But we had enough visibility, we could still fly visually, and that's what you need to do when you're flying the bucket around anyway, supporting those firefighters. But it was definitely an eye-opener on what the devastation of those fires can do and what they do to the environment you're flying in.
So yeah, what exactly was your mission out there? You mentioned a bucket.
Okay, so we fly the CH-47 Chinook helicopter, and that's made by the Boeing Aircraft Corporation. The Army typically uses those to move cargo and personnel around the battlefield, or in this case, fly a 2,000-gallon what we call a Bambi bucket. That's the brand of it. It's sling loaded on a long line underneath the helicopter, about 130 feet. And that allows us to dip into a lake, gathering up to 2000 gallons, except it just, it depends on the, what altitude you're dropping at and everything. We might have to, like, we had our bucket cinched to 80% just to keep ourselves from lifting too much weight because of all those capabilities. Just the, it's a very dynamic environment there where the, we were based in, near Sacramento at say 98 feet above sea level. And then we'd fly to a heli base, near the fire, which was 500 feet. And that, I mean, that's really not that much of a change. I mean, you'd think with the coastline, everything wouldn't be a big deal, but when we were going to drop, they had a possibility of being at 6,500 feet. So we don't have anything in Illinois near that. So luckily for us, I mean, a lot of our pilots and crew members, we've flown down in Afghanistan and Iraq and seen different terrain and trained on that. We actually just got back from our annual training was out in Nevada. And basically we weren't flying the bucket there, but we were flying troops and stuff around Nevada, dealing with the mountains and the heat and everything. But the bucket, we can sling load that water, getting direction from the way that Cal Fire does it. They have like a helicopter coordinator and he's sitting next in an airplane next to a aircraft coordinator. So there's aircraft dropping the different, like either water or deterrent.
The red fire retardant. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. So the dropping that stuff from fixed wing, they have to clear us out of the area while they're doing that. And then, so we've got the bucket when they call us. I mean, otherwise we sit at the heli base and we wait on standby, but our bucket's, you know, primed, ready to go. Take that out. We dip it in the lake. They tell us where they want it dropped. And again, that's clear of all the ground firefighters and everything. And I mean, it really was rewarding. I mean, I could see the videos I shared with you guys. If you look real close, you can see the firefighters up on the right side of the aircraft on the hill. That's who we were actually supporting in those videos I sent you.
Yeah.
But well, rewarding being able to see who you're supporting.
Yeah. And so I want to get maybe if you guys talking to each other a little later, and I'm going to come back to what it's actually like flying a helicopter with what looks like a swimming pool attached to the bottom of it. But Tom Gargave, you're acting fire manager at the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. You recently led a crew, as I mentioned earlier, to the Pine Gulch fire in Colorado. Can you paint a picture from the ground? What is it like being near or in the middle of one of these wildfires on the ground?
Well, you know, it depends on different days, Brian, what the fire intensity is. Sometimes you go direct right at the fire front. Sometimes you're out ahead of it. Working out ahead of it. So when it gets there, you're prepared. A lot of times we'll do backfiring operations, et cetera. But when the fire front is right on you, you got to have your head on a swivel. You're paying good attention. Those guys in the air are absolutely wonderful and good for our support. And we can talk about that later. But from the ground operations level, mostly you're looking at what that intensity is, what direction it's burning, and attacking it safely, yet also with vigor and aggressively.
And, you know, just for our listeners who may not be as familiar with wildland firefighting, I mean, I think they're used to seeing local community firefighters putting out building fires. I mean, you're not going into a wildland fire with a hose and water, though, right? So what are you actually doing out there? How is it different from fighting a more, you know, urban fire, for example?
Well, ground crews, really, you know, if you think about a campfire, you know, you can't stand any closer to a campfire than 2 or 3 feet. So once that fire gets up, you know, above your head, you're backing up and you're waiting for those guys in the air to cool it down for you. But that low, slow backing fire or that advancing fire can turn larger. So when it gets smaller, you go right at it. And that involves digging trenches, cutting some line in. We do set up pumps and hoses. We'll pump out of a creek or a beaver pond or anything we can find, or even off of an engine, and we'll run hoses and lines right through the woods and spray water on it. That's fairly common. Mostly we're digging line, though, or scratching line in with chainsaws ahead of that fire, not direct, but ahead of that fire or the fire's, you know, advancing and coming. And then we're relying on some of those air operations to cool it down and to slow it down so that we can continue with that ground operation.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today, we're revisiting a conversation from September with two Illinoisans who had just returned from fighting wildfires out west. My guests were Illinois Army National Guard Chief Warrant Officer Jason Rassi, who was pilot in command of a CH-47 Chinook helicopter dispatched to California, and the Illinois Department of Natural Resources Tom Gargave, a forester and fire manager who'd been sent to Colorado. Here's the rest of our conversation. Chief Rassi, I want to ask you, for you're flying a Chinook helicopter. Listeners might not be familiar with that by name, but they've probably seen one, at least on TV, if not in real life. Can you describe it and what it's like flying one, both in, you know, ordinary circumstances and with, as I said earlier, maybe like a swimming pool attached to the bottom?
Well, it is similar to a swimming pool in it per se, but it's got a valve at the bottom that they can electronically control from the back of the helicopter. And I've got my two pilots up front. If you can think of this as kind of like a flying school bus, and that's what a lot of the other helicopters will give us grief about. They say we look like a school bus flying around, but.
And this has the twin rotors, right? The rotor on the.
Twin rotors on top. And if you want to move a bunch of people and get them somewhere real quick, you use a Chinook helicopter, and that's the way the Army does it. But as far as the crew on board, I've got two pilots, and in this mission I had two flight engineers, and those are my eyes and ears in the back of the helicopter. And I'm flying the helicopter with my other pilot, but anything behind me, I have to rely on them. I mean, you think about trying to back a school bus into a parking spot or something like that, you listen to the guy in the back that can see much better than you can. And then we also took two maintainers with us that unfortunately they didn't get to fly along on the missions, but they were back at the base and helping get the aircraft ready to, you know, clean it up at the end of the day and get it ready for the next mission. The Chinook, though, like I said, we move people and stuff where we need to go. You're going to see those when we launched a couple years ago, 2011. We went out to Hurricane Irene in Vermont. So we were doing moving pallets full of food, water, blankets, and you drop those off in a field and then come back an hour and a half later and it's all gone. I mean, you can really see that the people need that stuff. And we also did a couple other flooding missions here in Illinois that year and also up in Sioux City, Iowa. But it's one of those weird ones where it always seems to happen on Labor Day weekend. And I was telling our public affairs guy about it. And I mean, so one Labor Day weekend, we were getting maple syrup in Vermont. And then this Labor Day weekend, we were getting In-N-Out Burger in California. So it really just depends on where they decide to send us.
So Tom, I want to ask you about wildland firefighting in Illinois. I don't think this is something that's, you know, among the many natural disasters that Illinoisans are subject to, flooding, tornadoes. People don't think of wildfires, maybe at least not in central and northern Illinois. But why does Illinois have wildland fighting people, wildfire crews, I should say?
Yeah, good question, Brian. Each state assists the U.S. Forest Service as well as the Park Service and Department of Interior and Bureau of Indian Affairs and Fish and Wildlife Service. And each state assists those agencies, those federal agencies, with a fire program. And Illinois has a wildland fire program that we have selected a unique group of guys that have trained and girls that have trained for this and they're ready to go. We've had this program since around 2000, and we've provided crews and personnel out there each year since then, or since that time period, to help serve and protect our national forests. It is unique to Illinois. A lot of folks don't know we exist even, but we do send 20-man crews out every year.
And do you, I'm curious then now about the coordination between air and ground support. I mean, you look at this, and I got to thank Chief Rassi and the National Guard. You shared some photos and video. We're going to post those at our website, 21stshow.org. It's really a unique perspective to see from the inside of the Chinook as one of these buckets is being emptied, both the aircraft in front of yours as well as then pointing down. That's not a perspective we get to see very often, but in some ways it looks like, you know, trying to put out a bonfire with a Dixie cup. And so what, you know, I guess, Tom, I'll start with you from the ground perspective. Is there good coordination between the ground crews and the air crews, and what are they doing to support you?
There is, absolutely. I have called in those helicopters before on our air attack frequency, And Chief, we're real glad to have you when I'm on the ground looking up. You know, I've called them in and we'll give them the coordinates. We'll use a clock face to bring them in. Depending on the size of the fire, each fire is rated. So as you get into a larger incident, it might be a type 2 or a type 1 incident. That means it's a large fire with many, many resources. The smaller fires that get into 3, 4, and 5 type incidents, they may have a Chinook or an Apache come by and drop a couple of buckets. And those guys are working multiple events, multiple fires. So they're dumping water and moving on to the next fire. And in between their fuel cycle, they may not be back to you. So you rely on those guys to make a good hit. We'll make on the ground, I'll put flagging out, or I have an orange ribbon, I'll lay it out, and I'll be speaking with the guys up in air attack, and they're looking down at me, and I'm giving them clock face signals to where to go ahead and dump.
And that allows 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, that's what you mean, right? Like when you say clock
face
signals. Correct, yes. Yeah.
Yep. And they're real good about it. Some of them are better than others, I'll be quite frank, but you know, any water, when you're down there and 300 gallons of water is dumped right next to you, you're glad to have it. And I've been sprayed before, and that's my own fault for not getting out of there. But we want to make accurate drops, and for the most part, they are wonderful.
Well, Chief Rassi, just a couple of minutes left in our conversation, but I'm curious from your perspective in the air, how challenging is it to hit your mark? And I mean, I guess once the water's being released, you're not even really looking down, right? Helicopters, you're looking ahead.
No, I can't see it from the front. I can only see where we're going. And I mean, I can see that aircraft in front from that video. So, I mean, you get a perspective of where we need to go. And that was multiple drops in the same location. And those firefighters had requested that, like he was saying, through the air attack frequency. But that helicopter coordinator up in the other aircraft, you know, he's coordinating. You've got, us talking to each other. You've got us. We have the way that Cal Fire ran it, we had a military helicopter manager on board, and he's a firefighter. Basically, he can talk the lingo when it gets into the specifics. And I mean, they were giving us not only clock positions, but they might give us the head, the shoulder, just basically as much specifics as they can. The one thing they wanted to stress to us, you're supporting the firefighter. You're not going to, you know, like we said, we're not going to put the fire out. It's too big. You know, it looks like an eyedropper but you're protecting those firefighters so they can do their job using bulldozers, using chainsaws, like he was saying. But the one thing that they told us, like, you know, you're going to have a lot of times that they're going to say that was a perfect drop in the wrong spot. But the point is, you got the water on site, and it's keeping that from, you know, you're supporting them and doing what you need to. And okay, come back and get it in a different spot next time.
All right. I think we're going to have to leave it there. This has been a really interesting conversation. I want to thank both of you for taking time out of your day to be with us today. Tom Gargave is acting fire manager and an operations forester for the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. And Jason Rassi is a chief warrant officer and was pilot in command for the Army National Guard's Chinook helicopter that helped with fighting the California wildfires. Thank you both so much again for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up after the break, we continue airing some of our favorite news segments from 2021. News, but news that was not directly, at least, related to COVID-19. Last up is going to be my conversation with the Illinois State Board of Education 2021 Illinois Teacher of the Year, Justin Johnson. That is coming up after a short break. I also want to mention that tomorrow on the program, we're going to be continuing to revisit some of our favorite conversations. Tomorrow, it's President's Day. We'll bring you 2 interviews with authors who've looked at how the actions of past presidents still echo today, especially in how they dealt with the press. Before we take a break, I also want to mention we would love to hear from you, our listeners. We put this question to our text group this week, but we'd love to hear from you about the conversations you wished we would have had this year. Maybe something that was in the news, didn't make the cut for one of our programs for whatever reason. We'd love to hear your perspective on that. Send us an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Or better yet, leave it in a voicemail for us. The number to call is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. More to come after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. This is music from the Wind Ensemble at Niles West High School in Skokie, Illinois. Our final non-COVID news story conversation we're airing today begins back in October when Governor J.B. Pritzker announced Justin Johnson, the director of bands at Niles West, would be the 2021 Illinois Teacher of the Year. Here's a clip of the governor announcing the award.
Mr. Johnson is director of bands at Niles West High School in Skokie, where he leads the marching band, the Wind Ensemble, and a long list of other musical groups that he created just to give every student an opportunity to challenge themselves and stretch their talent. Under his leadership, these groups have won several prestigious awards. But today's award isn't just about music. It's about how Mr. Johnson uses music to foster inclusion, equity, access, and goodwill.
I spoke with Justin Johnson in November. Here now is that conversation. So, Justin, where we ended that clip, Governor Pritzker goes on to talk about how you're honest about having yourself not been the best student growing up and how you credit your teachers with pushing you to your full potential. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and how your experiences growing up helped shape you into the teacher you've become today?
Sure. And like I said, when I was a youngster, I was not the best student. Not that I wasn't smart. I just, you know, my attitude didn't allow for me to be great in the classroom. And luckily for me, I encountered at a really early age a teacher who saw something in me and she never let it go. So this is the would have been my first grade year. Dr. Joan Hartman saw something in me, and I still remember to this day, she pulled me in the hallway and we had a very tough conversation regarding my attitude. And she let me know that she thought I was one of the smartest kids in there, but my attitude wasn't going to take me very far. So from that point on, she kind of put her arm around me and kept trying to direct me to a pathway that would allow me to kind of see that potential through. So I'm appreciative of her for doing that, because she didn't have to do that, you know. So I'm very, very thankful to have encountered her early on in my career.
Do you find yourself being in that role now where the student has become the teacher, putting their arm around a kid and saying, you know, you're a good kid, but you need to straighten up and fly right, so to speak?
Yeah, I actually do. And a lot of that is because I know how much it impacted me. And I don't just do it for those students. I try to do it as best as I can with the time that I have for all of the students, because you never know what that conversation or what someone else showing confidence or telling someone that you see potential in them can do for them. So I try to do it as much as I can for as many students as I can all the time.
So can you talk a little bit about how you came to be interested in music and when you knew you wanted to be a band teacher? And I guess I should say, full disclosure, I is one of the many college majors I considered and explored in my own checkered academic history was being a music education major. But how did you come to that path?
Well, when I first went to college, I actually wasn't a music education major. I didn't really dive into music education until after I actually left college after my second year. I wasn't doing very well. I'm from a small town. So, you know, being in that big environment, again, had some relapses on not being such a great student. But in my time away, it just made me grow and realize how much I loved making music. And I felt like teaching was something that I was good at. And that was purely from experiences that I had when I was in high school, from marching band to my band director at the time saying, hey, I want you to take these students and help them do this or work with people on here. Can you go teach this person this? And I kind of tapped back into those experiences and went, hey, I was pretty good at that. And this is something that I'm passionate about. So I should probably go and see if that's for me. And here I am all these years later.
What was your instrument growing up?
I played saxophone, and then I actually taught myself how to play another instrument so I can march drum and bugle corps. So I kind of taught myself how to play a mellophone, which is like a marching French horn.
Sure.
Just so I could go march drum and bugle corps. So those are my two like main instruments as I grew up.
Nice. And so you ended up doing drum corps as well as high school marching band?
Yes, I did drum corps for a couple years, and then I'm still involved in the activity in a teacher role, the same corps that I marched when I was younger. So that's been rewarding as well.
Oh, nice. So in the governor's comments, he mentions how beyond just being a music teacher, you've demonstrated an ability to use music to foster inclusion and equity, access, and goodwill. Can you talk about some of the challenges and opportunities to do that at your school, Niles West in Skokie?
Yeah, music has become kind of an elitist activity where if you don't have the money to get a good instrument or take private lessons or things of that nature, it can kind of exclude students. And I think that there are a ton of students out there that have talent. I think everyone has a talent or could potentially foster the talent to play an instrument or sing or do the arts in general. And there's a big stigma around music that if you don't buy the best instrument or take private lessons, that you're not going to be able to kind of thrive in that scenario. And I really work to break down that kind of mindset, because I feel like if you're willing to put work in and do the things that you're being taught, that there's no cap on how good you can become playing the instrument. And of course, if there's means to help students get those extra helps and that extra help, and that's always going to help push the envelope. But it's kind of becoming a place where if you don't have a certain socioeconomic status, then people look at it like the music isn't going to be for you. So in my program specifically, I'll speak to, we really work with one of our parent organizations to be able to provide free or reduced lessons for students who have financial need, structuring my class time where students get as much individualized attention as they can, with me being the only director. So periodically we'll bring in extra professionals on the instrument that'll work with students in smaller group settings, just things that I feel like help make an impact to push students to improve without a bigger financial burden on their parents.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. Listeners, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're replaying my interview from November with the 2021 Illinois Teacher of the Year, Justin Johnson. This award is decided by the Illinois State Board of Education. Johnson is director of bands at Niles West High School in North Suburban Skokie. Here's the remainder of our conversation. I have to wonder, teaching band, I imagine, is challenging enough, but now we're in the middle of a pandemic. How have you had to adjust your band classes for COVID-19 at Niles West?
I guess I can say for many directors across the state that it is a huge challenge. And, you know, when we did all of our coursework, undergrad, graduate, none of it focused on teaching band over a computer screen. So,
no, you know,
luckily for most musicians, we're already trained to always be attempting to improve ourselves and grow our skill set. So naturally for us, we dive into it like, okay, let me go and check out all these websites and extra tools for students to use. And, you know, that's kind of a natural progression, but it's been a very, very difficult challenge considering all the barriers that there are. I mean, there's no way to really play together as an ensemble over a computer screen. And for most every musician that you'll meet, that's the thing that drew them to music, is making music with others. And that's the thing that is virtually impossible to do over a computer screen. So this time has led to a lot of videos and me attempting to hear the students play individually during our class time on Zoom, but it's very, very difficult to, and again, it's impossible to recreate the ensemble experience over a computer screen. So we're kind of just left preparing with the hope that soon we'll be able to make music together again.
Yeah. And, it, you know, so much of the band experience is not just the music, but also just the activities outside of that and being together. And I know that, you know, I guess I can give a shout out to my own high school band director, Greg Bim, who was such an important teacher in my life. But I mean, I imagine, you know, you're part-time counselor for a lot of students. How has that aspect of band, I mean, have you been able to translate that to the virtual school environment?
Well, yeah, that piece is still kind of there because, you know, before or after class, I'm able to have conversations with students. And although it's not in person, we can still check in with people. If I see a student that's not, that looks like they're not having a great day, I can send them a message in the chat like, hey, hang on after the meeting so I can talk with them and just check in on them, which I have found myself doing even more of that than I was before. Back when we were in school, my room was always like busy because there were kids coming in, whether it be to come practice or just to hang out. There were always students in the room every portion of the day, every free period. So there's not that since we're virtual, but they're still like the checking out, the checking in, or a student hanging on to tell me about a basketball game. They know I like sports, so they'll hang out after class and ask me who I think is going to win the football game, or, you know, they'll stay and make fun of the Titans if the Titans lose, even though I'm not a Titan fan. I'm just from Tennessee. So stuff like that still happens, but, you know, not the personal conversations that we would have day to day, seeing them in the hallway or just hanging out in the room, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, is your band one of the, a lot of bands, not only, you know, people might think of Friday Night Lights playing at the football game, but a lot of bands do other competitions around the state. There's a big one at Illinois State every year. I imagine all that's on hold this year as well.
Yeah, that was a big blow. And I mean, it kind of started back in March when we shut down. We actually got shut down the week before our concert. So for all the seniors that I had last year, I felt so terrible that we had prepared this amazing concert of like favorite literature that they've ever played. And then the weekend before we were scheduled to have our spring concert, things shut down. So we were already kind of left with that empty feeling. And then for my seniors this year, we come back at it like, you know, thinking that things will kind of be better once we hit the summer, and they aren't. So here we are now with an entire year of marching band season that we don't get to go and compete with our show. So I actually spent a substantial amount of time over the summertime planning for a show and thinking about uniform, costuming, props, and things of that nature. And there's no season because there's nowhere to go compete.
Yeah.
So wow, that was a big blow. And, you know, for me, it's not so much for me, because I've had my years of, you know, competing with drum corps or high school marching band and the concerts and competitions. It's more the feeling that I have for the students, especially the seniors, who are super awesome. But here we are in their senior year and they're kind of left with it being unfulfilled because they're not able to finish that year with their best performances that they've had in high school. So they're the ones that I kind of think about the most in this entire thing, because they're the ones that are going to look back and go, man, what could my senior year have been if this thing didn't happen? So
last question, now that you are the Illinois Teacher of the Year for 2021, of course, that's a great honor, but can you talk about your proudest moment as a teacher?
My proudest moment as a teacher actually has happened a ton, but it's when I get the student that I know we had like a rocky start and I was probably tough on them because I saw something in them. And then years down the road, whether it be their senior year or after they graduate and they go on to college and do great things, they contact me back and say, thank you, because I know I needed what you were telling me and I didn't hear you at the time, but I appreciate you telling me now that I'm an adult. That's the thing that I'm the most proud of and that I hope to continue to have happen, because I was that person before. And my job as a teacher, for me, and a main goal of mine, is to continue to give that back to students for the entire time that I teach. So,
all right, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank Justin Johnson, who is, as I said, the 2021 Illinois Teacher of the Year. He teaches music at Niles West High School in Skokie. Justin, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That is all the time we have for today. As we end our show, we're going to listen to some music from Justin Johnson's ensemble at Niles West High School in Skokie, Illinois. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's President's Day. We're going to bring you two conversations with authors who've looked at how the actions of past presidents still resonate today, especially in how those presidents dealt with the press. We'd love to hear what you thought about today's program. You can always send us an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org, or better yet, leave us a voicemail, 217-321-21 is the number to call. That's 217 800-300-2121. Our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Our interns are Zainab Qureshi, Briel Skullark, and Chantel Vaca. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll talk to you tomorrow.